Welcome to Gravity, a podcast on the environment and human rights issues from the local to the global. Every morning I wake up and I have a cup of coffee. I love my coffee. I love dipping my croissant into my latte in the morning. I love my post-lunch cortado, and having fresh beans to grind is a priority in my home. And I'm not alone. Globally, we drink 2 billion cups a day. It's an integral part of many of our lives. So what are the human rights and planetary health concerns of the drink that we love so much? Coffee is the sixth driver of deforestation in the world, which reduces carbon sequestration, reduces critical habitat and leads to zoonotic disease, reduces biodiversity, and in turn amplifies the cumulative crises of climate change. Forced labour and child labour are prevalent in the industry, and while your cappuccino may have come to a whopping $7 from your local barista, how much of that goes to the farmer? A paltry pittance of some sense. Farmers are at the whimsy of the capricious global commodities market, and even when coffee is priced high, they get the least amount, despite undertaking the most arduous labour. While innovative agricultural practices allow for coffee to be grown outside the bean belt, such as in Southern California, it's mostly grown throughout the global south. But it's the global north that makes the most money out of coffee. We need to pay coffee farmers a fair price for their labour. We need to address these pernicious structural issues both through consumer activism and at the governmental level to ensure that certification schemes are not voluntary and specious, but ensure compliance throughout the entire value chain. On December 31 this year, the EUDR comes into effect to force companies to undertake due diligence to ensure their imported products do not cause deforestation or degradation or are made illegally, such as through forced or child labour. The US Forests Act, which also aims to prevent importation of products causing illegal deforestation, is still languishing in Congress. We need to expand it to cover coffee, legal deforestation of old-growth forest, and forest degradation. And we need to pass it. Coffee can be good for the planet. Shade-grown coffee is an agroforestry practice that grows coffee amongst a canopy of diverse trees, providing a critical habitat for diverse species, regenerating the soil, sequestering carbon, and mitigating climate change. Shade-grown coffee can be good for people as it ensures that the land will continue to be productive and allows the farmer to mix crops. Mixing of crops allows the farmer to have food security and provides the farmer with less vulnerability to the volatility of the price of one commodity. Paying the farmer a living wage ensures that the farmer can send their children to school and not perpetuate a cycle of poverty. I spoke to Ethel Gonet, the founder and executive director of the coffee watchdog Coffee Watch, who has long been an environmental activist and attorney protecting our world's forest, on the human rights and planetary health issues concerning coffee and its promising future. Welcome to Gravity FM, Ethel.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here.
So tell me, how did you end up starting Coffee Watch and why?
Yeah, you know, this is a great question. Sometimes I ask myself that. Why are you not just drinking mojitos or doing something a little calmer with your life? But no, the real answer is that coffee is the number six driver of deforestation in the world. And, you know, I'd worked for so long on other top drivers for Greenpeace and Mighty Earth and stuff like that, you know, working on cattle and soy and palm oil and cocoa and rubber, but coffee just gets such short shrift. You know, it's crazy. It's the number six driver of deforestation in the world, but like nobody really works on that at all. I mean, some people work on rolling out solutions, which I think is great, like rolling out agroforestry pilots here and there. But nobody's working in a watchdog capacity to kind of document the deforestation and call it out and campaign against it and combat it and fight it. And that's the only way we've seen deforestation change in other high-risk commodities. So it stands to reason that's how it would probably change in coffee too, you know?
Right. And the coffee market has increased. I think we drink, it yeah. used to be 500 million cups. Now it's like 2 billion cups a day. I know I drink 2 cups a day. I love my coffee. So there's that.
I would probably be a clearer thinker if I drank 2 billion cups of coffee, but I might be unbearably wired for everyone around me. I definitely think I cannot operate without 2 cups of coffee, as you know, because you've seen me. So without 2 cups of coffee, I'm like a discombobulated, drunken little hedgehog wandering around in circles.
I love that expression. I agree that I feel like a discombobulated, shrunken little hedgehog too without coffee. But because we love it so much, we should know how coffee comes to us and what it's causing, because there's deforestation issues, there's human rights abuses and other labor abuses. But before we get into coffee, I should have said welcome back to Gravity FM, because we talked about monocultures before and deforestation quite a few years back, and we concentrated on palm oil. But it's not just palm oil, it's rubber, it's cattle, it's soy. So let's talk about why reforestation and retaining forests is important, both for carbon sequestration and biodiversity.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you're getting to the heart of the matter. The truth is that forests don't need humans, really, but we need forests. If you enjoy breathing, then you secretly enjoy forests because you would not be breathing without forests. They are kind of the lungs of our planet in a way, as is the ocean, which is filled with little useful plants and plankton that help us breathe, without which we would all die. So basically, we have got to just shower the last remaining forests with love and attention and save them. You know, although they're so vital for our survival, we are killing them, which is kind of crazy. It means we're also killing ourselves. Oh no, please, let's not do that. So yeah, we're definitely munching away at the forests that are left. And as you pointed out, there are basically 7 commodities that are killing forests around the world. You could think of them as like the 7 deadly sins of deforestation. We mentioned almost all of them. It's cattle, soy, palm oil, pulp, and paper. Those are the 4 big titans. But then after that, you have cocoa, coffee, and rubber. So coffee is number 6 of global deforestation. And those, it's good news and bad news, right? Because it's good news, we only have to get on top of 7 commodities and stop them raping our forests. And it's bad news because there are 7 of these deadly sins. So, you know, you can think of it glass half full, half empty. I'm like a mug half full person. So, yeah.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Why wouldn't you take the positive outlook and the drive of things? So, when we're talking about deforestation and how important it is to stop that and retain particularly ancient growth forests, we need biodiversity to preserve the ecosystem. If we have monocultures, we lose biodiversity, we lose critical habitat. And what that means is we make it more susceptible to fire and we make us more susceptible to zoonotic diseases, because what happens is animals come near us.
Yep.
And then we get diseases from them, it mutates, and lo and behold, we have a new pandemic.
COVID.
It's planetary health, right? Our health is so intrinsically connected to environmental health.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, everything that you just said is yes to all of that. You know, basically, we are pretty sure now that not only a third of climate change is due to agriculture. Most of that is like deforestation. But there's other problems with agriculture too. But so a third of climate change, but also 80% of biodiversity loss. And, you know, a lot of your viewers may know this, but it's probably worth underscoring. We are actually in mass extinction. Like the era of the Anthropocene is characterized by a mass extinction. And that's underpinned by something called the insect apocalypse. You can Google New York Times Magazine and Mongabay, and all of these scientists have been talking about this insect apocalypse. And basically, the devastation of insects is like rippling through the trophic chain, right? And as you get higher and higher up the pyramid, you know, if insects vanish, then the birds that depend on them vanish, et cetera. But think about it this way. We are the apex predators in that little pyramid, right? If the bottom of the pyramid vanishes, that's not so good.
We come crashing down to...
Exactly. And monoculture is almost like a kind of biodiversity desert. Mm. So when you talk about that, wow, it's so important. We've got to change course from deforestation and pesticide-soaked monoculture, which are driving not only climate chaos, but biodiversity collapse. And we've got to turn agriculture around. And the nice thing about coffee is that coffee loves trees. Coffee lends itself so well to beautiful, biodiverse agroforestry that's regenerative, that heals the planet, that brings back, you know, bugs and bats and birds, and that is actually making the world a better place with every cup. So we know we need to transform agriculture and get off this bad track onto a good track. And coffee is like the perfect poster child for how we can do that, because coffee lends itself to good agriculture so well. We have just randomly chosen to do like the worst kind of coffee. We're like, oh, let's have coffee with deforestation, slavery, pesticides, of monoculture, and child labor. That sounds good. Rape. Why did we decide? That's like a crazy decision. We can totally choose a different way. We can, we should.
I think it's because the people that own the land decided on short-term profits. So if you're talking about the monoculture coffee plantations that require the sun and that require a lot of pesticide for high yield, short-term profits, yes, maybe you do get a higher yield, but long-term, you're going to erode the soil. You're not going to be able to have any yield from that soil, and then you're going to have to move your plantation elsewhere. Whereas I believe what you were talking about was agroecological practices or agroforestry, yes, when you have a mix of crops. And that also, from an income perspective, helps farmers because you have fluctuations in crop price. If one falls, then another crop might not. And so with this biodiversity, you can regenerate the soil and you don't need as much pesticide, etc. So can you tell me more about agroforestry practices with coffee?
What you said is so spot on. I think it bears like returning to what you said and kind of underlining that, underscoring that. You talked about how different the biodiversity outcomes are. But let's give some numbers just to kind of make it more tangible for people, right? You talked about monoculture versus shade-grown agroecological, agroforestry coffee. We think that in monoculture, on average, you have around 61 bird species, whereas in a beautiful agroforestry coffee system with ideal shade, like shade-grown coffee, you have 243 species. That's a huge difference.
That's right? Great, yeah.
1 to 243, it's a game-changingly different system. And it's not just that the biodiversity outcomes are amazing and the carbon is amazing, right? You tend to have double the carbon in an agroforestry coffee system. But you also talked about farmer well-being, because basically it turns out that agroforestry coffee isn't just good for the planet. It's great for farmers. Yes, of course, it's good for carbon, it's good for biodiversity, it's good for soil health and soil moisture that protects your crops, even if it's like a drought. And it's good for soaking up lots of water if you're in a superstorm. Trees act like sponges, so they regulate the soil moisture. But for people, it's almost even better than it is for the planet. And what do I mean by that? You talked about like farmer income diversification. Let's just give an example. Let's say farmer Etel is doing coffee and nothing but coffee. Just like you said, the price of coffee in the global market's high. Farmer Etel is doing great. Price of global coffee falls through the floor. I am screwed, like royally screwed. I am hostage to the vicissitudes of market shocks. That's really mm-hmm. my income. It's yeah. like I told you, oh, you should just invest in nothing but Tesla. Trust me, it's going to be great. And you're like, wait, but that's not a very stable stock. I don't know if I
mean, right. You got to diversify.
Maybe I should have a different portfolio. Mm-hmm. They need income diversification. It means farmer Itzel needs to actually have like 4 or 5 crops, because otherwise, if one crop fails because of a pest or because the rains were wonky that year or because the price was crazy and went through the floor and we had just a terrible price that year, at least my family will not starve, right? And talk about starving. A lot of coffee farmers are very poor and they're literally food insecure. So not only can you make agroforestry systems that are good for the planet and good for income diversification, you can literally put trees in there that are food security trees. So like farmer intent family can go through the list of what do I eat? And you can work with me if you're buying my coffee and help me get seedlings for those things that I eat. So suddenly I have some food security inside my own farm. And if we do that with a co-op, like a whole bunch of us in our neighborhood, then suddenly our region can have real food security as well as income diversification. So what you said is so deep and profound. I think it needs to be unpacked and underscored.
Well, I think that what you said is very profound when you're talking about food security, because if all you're left with is the fluctuations of the global market, a bit of a digression, but in the 1960s, when you had the World Bank and the IMF come in and say, hey, you're going to grow coffee, and hey, you're going to grow this, instead of subsistence farming, when people actually had food security, now they're trapped, right, in this system. In the 70s, I think there was a brief agreement where you had a set minimum price for coffee that was good for coffee producers. But then in the 80s, that just went kaput. And we don't have that anymore. But I think what most people don't understand, when you see, oh, a fair trade label, and we'll talk about the problems with certification and how that's actually becoming deceptive because people don't control the supply chains. But also, the farmer gets the least amount. They grow the crop. They probably do the most arduous work. And then they're actually just barely making a living, whereas actually roasting is where roasting and retail is where most of the money is. But where's coffee grown? It's actually only pretty much grown in the bean belt, which is 25 to 30 degrees above the equator and say 30 degrees or something below the equator. So we have this region of the global south, really, producing the coffee. And historically, coffee was produced under conditions of slavery. When we look at Brazil, which is the biggest coffee producer, most of the enslaved people that came to Brazil came to work on the coffee plantations, right? And we'll talk a bit later about labor conditions in Brazil today. But I think what people need to understand is that we still have the global north making most of the money from coffee that doesn't exist in the global north. It's something that we, again, take from the global south.
That's right. I mean, no, a lot of what you said is incredibly important because I think most coffee lovers and coffee drinkers have not clocked just how poor coffee farmers are. Coffee farmers are very, very poor indeed. Most coffee farmers hover at what the World Bank describes as the poverty line. And a lot of coffee farmers are at what the World Bank describes as the extreme poverty line, which is $2.15 a day. Almost no coffee farmers earn a living income. And a living income is exactly what it sounds like. It's an income that you can live on. It's like basic food, basic medical care, basic education for your kids. This is not a luxury income or a dignity income. Yeah. Your living income. Almost no coffee farmers are earning living income. And when you include coffee farm workers, then it's even lower. So yeah, like a New Yorkers would pay an average of like $3.12 for a cup of coffee at a deli. And coffee farmers would get just a few cents.
Yeah, $3 maybe for a cup of coffee. I'm thinking if you go in and you're paying like $7 for a cortado, which is not unheard of, right? In San Francisco, in LA, in New York, you're paying these prices. And how much is the farmer actually getting? A lot of it is going to the store, the retailer that sold the coffee, the roaster. Sometimes they're the one entity. But yeah, the farmer's getting the short end of the stick here for sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we can break it into percentages. If you're not looking at just like a low-end sort of cup of coffee in a deli, where shockingly out of $3.12, like the farmer gets just a couple cents. If you're looking at a fancy, like a latte in a higher-end cafe, it turns out that farmers get about 0.4% of your latte.
Whoa.
Yes, I know it's crazy. I know basically like 60% of your latte that will go to, you know, the shop and the rent and the staff, and 25% is profit and tax, and 4% is for milk, and 7% is for cup and napkins. 4% of your value of your cup goes to coffee, but very little of that quote coffee money goes to the farmer. A lot of that coffee money will, as you said, go to the roaster. If not the roaster, the trader. If not the trader, the person who aggregated it in warehouses before it even went to the trader who exported it or imported it. So yeah, the farmer is getting like 0.4%. It's nuts.
So let's, before we go back to the environmental issues, now that we're talking about how little the farmers get, so one unfortunate prevalence in the coffee industry or coffee agriculture is child labor. And that's simply because parents can't afford to send their kids to school. But then that perpetuates this cycle of poverty. So can you describe more about the research that you've done at Coffee Watch into child labor and debt bondage and other labor issues in the coffee industry?
Yeah. So there's a lot more that's known about child labor in other industries, because coffee, it's not just deforestation in coffee that's gotten short shrift. Human rights abuses in coffee get very little attention also. Let's start with what we know and then go into what we don't know. We know that agriculture overwhelmingly drives global child labor. It's like 1 in 10 kids worldwide pretty much are in child labor.
Oh, including in the U.S., people don't think so, but, and it's legal.
Oh, it's legal.
Because of our racist FLSA and its history. But anyway, people can look that up for another topic. Sorry, that'll go on.
And agriculture in the U.S. has like a special carve out and an exemption, essentially. Uh-huh. We can have a whole podcast just about that and how crazy it is. But agriculture mostly is what's driving global child labor. And coffee is driving a big chunk of the agricultural child labor crisis. So, you know, you can break it down into which sectors are the most high risk for child labor. And you can look at the number of countries associated with child labor that are producing that thing. So gold is higher than coffee, bricks, sugarcane, but coffee is basically like number 4. Even ahead of tobacco, cattle, cotton, and cocoa. That's just in terms of the number of countries where it's produced that have really high child labor. But when you start looking at the numbers, because there's so much labor in coffee, there are way more people in the coffee workforce than there are in bricks or tobacco or cocoa. It means that the absolute number of kids in coffee is probably much higher. And we know, although there's no like global study that's been done that's methodologically sound and coherent across all countries, there's been these individual studies that are done country by country that are quite reputable, that give us like windows, like the glimpses through these little windows into the house of child labor. So these academics did a research project on Ethiopia and found that 91% of Ethiopian coffee households use child labor. Another study done in Colombia, financed actually by the U.S. Department of Labor before it was doged, found 71% of coffee farming families use child labor. For Honduras, it's thought to be 64%. In Vietnam, the best available information from the government is that there's at least 34,000 kids in coffee. So yeah, we think there's probably 350,000 kids in Colombian coffee, probably 1.8 to 3.6 million kids in Ethiopian coffee, like half of Ugandan coffee seems to be tainted by child labor. We're talking about millions of kids when you add up Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Colombia, Honduras, et cetera, et cetera. When you just sort of look at it, it's as if we have a puzzle with lots of missing pieces, and the puzzle pieces were made by different people, but they're all there and they're screaming at us, oh my God, this is bad.
When we talk about child labor, right, we're not only talking about the fact that a child loses their childhood, but we're also talking about in agriculture really arduous work that could lead to injuries, sometimes permanent injuries, because they might not get the right medical care and because they continue to strain themselves where they have injuries. But also with coffee, there's a lot of pesticides where you have commercial coffee grown. And these pesticides lead to a lot of health effects. And for children, they can't process chemicals like adults. So it's compounded. It's a compounded effect on children.
That's right. So, you know, we have a couple of the best studies that were done on this issue of like what child labor means in coffee. And they just destroy the notion that, oh, you know, it's just kids helping their parents a little bit here and there, doing stuff that's quite nice and learning the family trade. And then, you know, they're doing it after school and on holidays. It's not a big deal. That's a fantasy. It turns out, as you said, a lot of the kids who are working coffee are doing back-breaking labor that literally costs them their education because they drop out of school in order to do this coffee work. And they lose so much school that they then get kept back a year, or they may entirely have to drop out, especially if you've been kept back once, twice, three times. It starts to become this insurmountable obstacle. So then not only were your parents so poor that they had to have you helping out to make ends meet, but you're denied an education. So you are going to therefore be poor and stay in this downward spiral. But we know like this amazing study was done in Uganda by an organization, the Ugandan group called AfriChild. They found that 4 out of 10 kids who were in coffee between the ages of 5 to 17, five to 17 years of age, 4 out of 10 of those kids were engaged in hazardous work. So 4 out of 10 of the kids were in hazardous child labor, which, as you said, is like exposure to chemicals, super heavy loads, or sharp objects. And yeah, in Ethiopia, that study that was done, that's the best study that we know of, found that 54% of the kids working in coffee faced absenteeism and ensuing penalties that endangered their ability to stay in school. So yeah, this is like small kids doing horrible work. Do we want that in our coffee? I don't want that in my coffee.
No, it doesn't taste as good when you think about that.
Oh my God, as a mom, you know, my sister's, my brother's kids, my son, like, if anyone tried to hurt them, I would like die for them. You know, I would chop off my right hand. Like, I have seen stuff that if someone did that to my child, I don't know, I would go ballistic. This is unacceptable. It is not acceptable.
I think all parents think that, and then some parents just don't have maybe the ability.
Most parents don't want to prevent that. Like the parents, absolutely, this is the last thing they want, literally. And we know that because every time they get more money for coffee because the price goes up, child labor goes down.
Yeah.
So we know that there's like a one-to-one correlation between adult farmers earning a living income or something closer to a living income and kids going to school. You talked about that time when the price of coffee was stabilized, right?
Yeah.
So important. There was like for well over a decade, a stabilized, much higher price of coffee. Then that thing, this international coffee agreement fell apart, as you said, exactly. It just like imploded and the price of coffee tanked. And school, it almost like tracks identically. School attendance plummeted in the coffee growing regions at those times.
Yeah.
This tells parents do not, and it's the same as you do when you do like interviews with people. Of course, these are not, you know, quantitative millions of people being interviewed. This is qualitative interviews, but the parents do not want their kids to be doing this. Not at all. They do it because.
I mean, but you got to eat, right? So.
Exactly. It's starve or work.
Starve or work. Yeah. I mean, it's such an arduous choice. And then, apart from child labor, there's also debt bondage. So there's a case against Starbucks right now in court. There are these gatos in Brazil, these people that are like hunters for workers, and they take them to very remote areas and the Brazilian government. So when they're trying to look at all these farms and help people that are in essentially enslaved labor, coffee was actually the number one culprit in Brazil. So you have cattle ranches that have slave labor, you have soy plantations, but it seems that at least, or you could say actually they just found out more about the coffee, but the majority of raids have been recently in coffee.
Yeah. So, you know, you're bringing us to something that I think is so shocking. Most people can't really process it when they hear it. Mm. You know, just like I think most folks do not know that coffee is the number six driver of deforestation, and they don't know that coffee is packed with child labor and, in fact, hazardous child labor even, and is rife with extreme poverty. Most people cannot actually believe that there's like slavery in their coffee. But the truth is, if you've just been drinking regular coffee without thinking about it and like all over the world, which I had done in my life, actually, especially when I was younger, you have been drinking slavery. And the reason I say this is Brazil is like the top coffee producing country in the world. They produce, depending on who you listen to, 31 to 39% of global coffee. So like around a third.
Yeah.
They're a titan, a behemoth. And between 1996 and 2023, Brazilian labor inspectors found 3,700 workers in slave-like conditions.
Wow.
In plantations in Brazil that supplied, apparently, allegedly, Starbucks and Nestle and other major brands. And those labor inspectors have only inspected around 0.1% of coffee farms in Brazil. So they found thousands of slaves inspecting only 0.1% of coffee farms.
Yeah. And that's just Brazil, right?
That's just Brazil.
In Colombia, they found it. In Mexico, they found it.
We find debt bondage and bonded labor in Indian coffee. We find forced labor in almost every country.
Sexual exploitation on some plantations.
But yeah, you just think about it. It's basically, if you're drinking the Brazilian coffee, the slavery, at least Brazilian civil society is so strong and adept and has these incredible heroes and heroines and a little bit more freedom than other places like Vietnam, which is a sort of closed dictatorship. It's the second biggest coffee producing country in the world. And Colombia is actually the most dangerous place in the world to be a union organizer. So it's basically almost a death sentence to try to fight for, you know, better price and farmers' rights and stuff in Colombia at certain times in certain places. But Brazil is also very dangerous for activists, I should add, extremely dangerous. But nonetheless, Brazilian civil society has managed to document stuff. And although the government has only visited like 0.1% of farms, the government is trying to do something, which is a lot more than you can say for many other countries. So as you said, they do these slave rescues. The problem is not that they're not doing any. It's just that it's not enough. By far, it's not enough. We know that 11% of the total rescues in Brazil are coffee slaves. And it's like the number one source of slave rescues in 2023.
Yeah.
We know it's a huge problem. And the Brazilian government is just very under-resourced. I think it's not that these are like bad people who are in cahoots with...
No, they're just under-resourced. It's the same with trying to stop arson in the Amazon. They're just under-resourced and it's really hard to find out where the fire is. And people are intentionally setting alight the forest so they could graze the land for soy and cattle plantations. Horrible, right?
But you know, we could say it is the job of the government to like raise taxes or do whatever it needs to get on top of problems like slavery and child labor and human trafficking. But at the same time, that is true. I think it's also important that consumers step up and speak up and do their part to pressure industry because, you know, we're all in this together.
Yeah.
The producer governments need to regulate and have better law enforcement, but consumers need to step up and get really freaking outraged and say, this is not okay. I do not want this in my morning cup of coffee. I do not agree. What are you up to? be clear with me. Where is your no deforestation policy? What are you doing about slavery? Where's your living income commitment? And I think, you know, when consumers rise up like a tidal wave, it will be so beautiful and it will be powerful. And I'm sure, I'm 100% believe in my heart that the day that consumers stand up and demand better coffee, that will be the day that the industry starts to really pull its weight. And then you could have this magic happen where consumers and industry and producer governments and consumer governments start to work together to actually change conditions and make them better, because we can change. There's like no reason why we have chosen to do such bad, crazy, awful coffee. We can go to the moon. We will definitely produce better coffee. In fact, some companies already do produce better coffee.
Right. So you want to go out there and you want to spend more money on coffee that's got all these certifications, right? It's like, oh, this is fair trade and certified by third parties that claim there's no deforestation and everything's great from a human rights environmental perspective. And then you pay extra, and you pay extra because you think that that money is going towards these good practices. Now, who is policing these certification schemes? Because the issue is you can put these labels on your coffee and get an increased price from consumers, and then consumers are voting with their dollar, right? But if you don't have entities like Coffee Watch looking at certification schemes and wondering, well, do these companies really know about their supply chains like they're saying they do know, and then deceiving consumers potentially? Maybe they don't know, but they shouldn't be putting that certification there if they can't control their own supply chains.
So it's really funny because you asked who is policing the certification schemes, and I was like, Coffee Watch, I guess?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying. If we don't have entities like Coffee Watch, because you have investigated several large producers, right? Yeah.
So actually, I mean, we've looked at certified coffee in China, in Yunnan. Almost all Chinese coffee is grown in Yunnan. And it's kind of fascinating because Chinese demand for coffee has exploded. Used to be everybody in China drank tea. You know, that slowly started to change. Now there are literally like almost about to be more Starbucks in China than in the US. And Starbucks, not even the biggest coffee company in China. So there's a lot of coffee being drunk in China and increasing amounts of coffee being grown in China, especially in Yunnan. So we sent investigators there. We found such serious violations of the certifications called 4C and CAFE practices. 4C is often used by Nestle, but other companies as well. And CAFE practices is the certification scheme used by Starbucks, exclusively for Starbucks, made by Conservation International, I think. Although it's a little complicated, but basically those two certifications, like the coffee we found was in violation over and over and over of their own standards. Then I was like, okay, let's check things out in Mexico. We worked with this incredible group in China. I should say we collaborated with China Labor Watch, who are amazing. Absolutely amazing rock stars. And then in Mexico, also, knock my socks off, awesome, awesome, awesome local groups called Empower and ProDesk. And we did this report called, the first one in China was called Ghost Farms and Coffee Laundering, because we found all these like horrible abuses in farms that were laundering their coffee into certified farms. Right, so like, farm and I do terrible stuff. And then I sell my coffee to you, and through you, it goes to like the So we basically, you and I are in cahoots to like launder the coffee. So that's a Chinese report. That's what we called it, Ghost Farms. But then we did a report in Mexico called Opacity and Exploitation. And again, we found real problems with certified coffee, especially 4C and CAFE practices. But then we sent another team to the ground in Colombia, and there we found violations of their own codes in fair trade coffee, Rainforest Alliance coffee, 4C coffee, CAFE practices coffee. When we looked at Brazilian coffee, we sort of did this big review of what everyone else has been studying. And there's been slavery in certified coffee. There was even conditions akin to slavery in the cup of excellence coffee, which is like the Emmys award of coffee. So what I can say is certified coffee, it has a lot of problems. And when you ask who is policing it, I would like to ask the same question. Totally right for just like one NGO to be trying to police this, but we're doing our best. The most important thing I would call on all the certifications to do is pay a living income price. Because if you pay a living income price and a living wage, a price is really for the farmers and a living wage is for like the farm workers who work on a daily basis, then I think that would go a very long way to reducing the risk of slavery and child labor.
Yeah. And this actually brings me to a certification scheme that is regulated by a government. This is the EU deforestation regulation, which will come into effect for most entities December 31 this year, and then for micro entities June 30th next year. This certification scheme is combating deforestation, but if you address the supply chain and want transparency in it, I think it will have the effect of also shining a light on human rights abuses.
And
hopefully limit that as well.
Oh yeah, it's pretty awesome. I mean, the sad thing is that a lot of companies, including coffee companies, lobbied incredibly hard to kill that law. Like, no. But yeah, these companies pulled out all the stops and tried to destroy and derail and delay the EUDR. And they complained so hard that they got all these right-wing politicians really agitated and then actually did get an entire year delay. So we should have started the EUDR this year already in January, but we're going to wait, as you said, until January next year. But look, if it doesn't get delayed again, which I sincerely hope it does not get delayed again, then it will be a game changer because it doesn't only stop deforestation. As you said, it requires traceability. You can't stop deforestation if you're not traceable. And it actually bars illegality. So that's interesting because in most countries where coffee is produced, rape, child labor, and slavery are illegal, and debt bondage and forced labor. So what's fascinating is that because those crimes are theoretically illegal in most coffee producing countries, the EUDR might actually stop not only deforestation, but also slavery.
Yeah.
And other associated abuses.
And it's not just a certification scheme. I should point out that this is a regulation where companies that don't comply will get penalized. Yeah, it's not, oh, put a label here or there. It's actually importation into the EU, entry into the biggest coffee market in the world.
That's right. The EU is a quarter of global coffee consumption. But you're absolutely right. It is the biggest market in the world. So yes, it's the most important. It's the biggest. And this law would cover everything, all the coffee coming into the EU. Basically, if I was a company trying to bring in dodgy slavery deforestation coffee, starting in January next year, I cannot do that.
So I have a little question about this law, because I've been thinking about it. And on the whole, I really like this law. And I think it's necessary. And I hope the US implements something to the same effect. But what I am concerned about is, because there's always unintended consequences of laws. And maybe I'm crazy, and I hope you tell me, you know what, Alex, you're totally crazy. This isn't going to happen. But if we look at small farmers, right, how are they going to be able to comply with the GPS issues and the traceability issues? And then what I'm concerned about is if they can't comply, are we going to have less competition and more conglomerates and then therefore more control of small farmers? Because you're going to have people with the resources being able to comply. If they comply and we don't have bad labor conditions and deforestation, then maybe what's the point of competition? But I think competition is inherently important and small farms are an inherent good in themselves because otherwise you can only look to a few producers. And then they also have the resources to throw you into court. They also have the resources to deceive. That's my concern about the law there.
Yes, I think the best way to approach this is to hope for the best and plan for the worst.
Mm.
You know, so I believe that we should be constantly scanning and vigilant in our scanning of what could be the negative, harmful, unintended consequences of the law, as you pointed out, and then do everything we can to mitigate those harms. Because if we exert continuous vigilance to make things implemented as well as possible for smallholders and for really impoverished, exploited Indigenous communities and very vulnerable workers, then we increase the chances that the law will be helpful to them and not hurtful, right? So I think there's been these waves of efforts to get people land tenure.
Mm.
And that's super important because actually without land tenure, if you're a coffee farmer, you can't easily get access to lines of credit. And you may sort of sink into the ranks of the unbanked, which marginalizes and impoverishes you generally. So it is very important for people in general to get access to credit and to be banked, including like phone banking. It can lift millions of people out of poverty in a lot of ways that are quite surprising, but wonderful. So getting access to your land, getting land tenure, it brings you out of the shadows into a state of legality, right? The EUDR first legality.
Yeah.
So you can't have slaves, you can't rape your workers, you shouldn't have kids doing hazardous labor, but you also have to like be able to say, this is literally my land, right?
Yeah.
So there's been these big projects, some of which have been funded by the EU, some of which have been funded by member states like Germany, the what used to be GTZ, now GIZ, funded a lot of these things to basically get a lot of smallholder farmers in coffee their land tenure. But also, it's super important that there have been these big projects to, as you said, help farmers become part of that traceability chain, so get their polygons for their plots, their GPS points.
Yeah.
If we do not ensure that that is happening, then either happening because the Vietnamese government or Brazilian or Colombian or Indonesian government is doing it, or because the companies like Nestle and Starbucks are doing it, or because the aid groups and the humanitarian and development NGOs are stepping up. If it's not happening, then there is a real risk that smallholders without land tenure, which tend to also, the women and Indigenous people tend to be more than others, there is a risk that these already vulnerable, marginalized smallholders, many of whom are women or Indigenous or Afro-descendant, will be even more marginalized and not allowed
to. Yeah.
So we have to, I think, step up our game like a hundredfold to fix that issue. And I think that if we manage it, then the benefits will be multiple, right? Because then you can bring people out of the ranks of the unbanked, which is awesome for them to be able to get lines of credit. And who knows, like, the only data point we have on this, Alex, the Fuller team did an investigation in Pakistan after the German supply chain law kicked in.
Wait, I had no idea that Pakistan...
No, it's not coffee, it's garments. It's a garment.
Oh, okay. I was like, whoa.
It was the garment industry. So basically, the German supply chain law, the Lieferkettengesetz, has a lot of similar accountability and stringent transparency and traceability requirements that are sort of evocative of the EUDR, reminiscent of the EUDR, sort of in that same worldview and approach to cleaning up industry. The German supply chain law is already the law of the land. So we can see what impact it's had, and we can imagine, is that the impact that the EUDR will have? And these people in the Fuller Project investigated, okay, what impact did the German Supply Chain Act, the Lieferkettengesetz, have on the garment industry in Pakistan, which was known for forced labor and union busting and inadequate wages. And it's not as bad as what happened in Rana Plaza, you know, in Bangladesh, but pretty bad stuff, right? Child labor, blah, blah. And actually, it turns out the fashion brands were so worried about compliance with the German law that they started to get super squeaky clean and forced their suppliers to get super squeaky clean. And it triggered a big transformation in how the brands and the government lived up to their commitments in terms of people being able to join unions, unions being able to have bargaining sessions with companies without their leaders getting killed or threatened or whatever. It was a really awesome game changer.
That's great. You could export domestic law in a way to...
Yes.
Well, not if you have tariffs.
A lot of people are getting these written employment contracts instead of being ghost employees. So almost all farm workers in coffee are ghost employees. They very rarely have good, real written employment contracts. Mm. And because they're not really properly employed, then they're cut off from the possibility of Social Security and pensions and all this stuff. So you could imagine that there'd be a lot less union busting. People would stop trying to kill union leaders and farmer organizers or harass them.
Yeah.
You could imagine we'd get closer to living income. You could imagine that we would start seeing a big change in terms of people being moved out of the shadows into legal contracts. It's hard to tell, but I think what we have to do is we have to fight to make that happen. If we don't, then what will it be? The chances things are bad are greater. And if we fight to make it good, then the chances are that it will work out better.
It's great that Europe is doing this, because if Europe does this, then even if the coffee won't go to Europe, the chances are that it will have this ripple effect, right? Just because of global supply chains and navigating all that. And because there's such a big market with respect to any issues with small farmers being able to rely on this to be able to navigate the law, it's just an issue of capacity building, right?
Yes.
And so organizations focus on capacity building. But the other issue that they have to address is not to paternalize when they go in, but to support but not lead.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, I think my vision for Coffee Watch is that we help bring a bright light and shine that spotlight on the most courageous, vocal, adept activists around the world who have been trying to fix coffee. And we try to be the wind under their wings and try to force the industry to accept unions so that farmers and farm workers can represent themselves to demand their own rights. And in that way too, I think, you know, there's a way for consumers to stand up and speak out. You know, we have so much gorgeous, beautiful power. We can vote with our wallet every time we buy coffee. We can buy amazing coffee that's good for people and planet, that makes the world a better place with every cup. We can gift delicious, good, ethical, sustainable coffee for brunches, for house gifts, for Christmas, for birthdays, for Hanukkah, whatever.
Yeah.
People love coffee. It's a great present. Ethical coffee is an excellent present. We can post on social media. We can sign petitions. We can write to companies. We can write to our lawmakers. You know, there is so much we can do. We can talk to the baristas and the managers in our favorite cafes who know us, our favorite restaurants. We can change the coffee in the institutions that we're a part of, like a university or an office or a company. We have this immense power. Many farmers and farm workers are in horrible conditions of abuse and exploitation, and they don't have a voice. These children who are doing this awful work we talked about, they don't have a voice. We have a voice. It is up to us to give them their voice by changing the system so that they can advocate for themselves, and then we can be the wind under their wings. But that means that right now we do need to step up and speak out.
I agree. Yeah, we definitely need to do that. And I just found out the other day from your website, actually, that there's a coffee caucus, a congressional coffee caucus, and a bipartisan one.
Yes.
So we can call out our congressional representatives and ask them
to join the coffee caucus. And to fight for ethical coffee.
And fight for ethical coffee, yeah. there's a good law. The problem with Congress is they have a lot of good laws that just sit there and even have bipartisan support, and you don't, it's just,
but never give in, keep going, keep fighting. That law, that beautiful law you're talking about, that it's called the Forest Act.
Yeah, the Forest Act, yes. Can you explain to our audience more about the Forest Act?
You know, the EUDR is like this shining star in the firmament of laws that have been proposed to transform commodity agriculture, including coffee. It has a sister across the channel in the UK called the UKDR, which is also called the UK Environment Bill Schedule 17, but UKDR sounds better. And then across the pond in the US, we have a cousin, which is the Forest Act. And it's got bipartisan support in the House, bipartisan support in the Senate. It doesn't yet include coffee, but it includes the other high-risk commodities we talked about. And it would be a game changer. It's a beautiful bill. Let's get it passed. Yeah, so absolutely. You know, we're so lucky not to live in North Korea or a closed repressive dictatorship like Vietnam, which is the second biggest coffee producing country in the world. We're so lucky that we don't live in a narco state, you know, where you can have your fingers chopped off for complaining. We, mostly coffee drinkers, live in free, safe democracies, and American coffee drinkers can absolutely avail themselves of that gorgeous, fabulous privilege and power and send literally an email or a Facebook post or a tweet at their congressional representative and their senator and say, like, join the coffee caucus, pass the Forest Act.
Yes.
That is, like, just doing that is probably worth drinking 100 ethical coffees right there. Cha-ching!
Yeah, even as we backslide.
You know, there's always, I think, room for hope and action, always.
Yeah. Look, I'm staying positive still. I wanted to ask the backsliding in our democracy, and there's so many issues in the world. So how, as an activist and one that sees an integrative and holistic approach being the best approach, how do you defend if someone says, well, everyone should just focus on what Trump is doing, for instance, and not look at other issues? But then that kind of plays into his game, no? Because everything's integrated. And if we're not focusing on saving our planet, what are we going to do?
Look, I think that we are all capable of being sisters and brothers in an interlocking, beautiful patchwork quilt of activism where all the pieces together make it so much more beautiful and warmer, and they are connected. And sometimes there's a pattern between different parts of the quilt and it's obvious, and sometimes it doesn't quite make sense, but they're still stitched together. And if you get into a very siloed vision and you dedicate yourself 100% to fighting like crazy, awful, racist deportations, good on you. Why? Because those crazy, awful, racist deportations are terrible, and we need people to be kung fu fighters against that.
Right.
But I also think that when we're talking about migration and migrants being deported out of the United States, many of those migrants are desperate coffee farmers who came from coffee regions in Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras that are collapsing because of climate change, and because climate change brought them to the brink of extreme poverty, because they were already in poverty and coffee made them so vulnerable to these things that just could easily tip them over into catastrophe. Coffee is tied to migration and poverty, which is tied to deportation. So if you want to just be a kung fu fighter for coffee, sustainable coffee, you're also helping in a way. We're all helping each other.
Yeah.
If you want to change your cup of morning joe and also go fight for women's right to choose from 9 to 5, and then post online once a day about something people can do to fight the fossil fuel industry, amazing. You know, we can be multifaceted. We can be in allyship. It makes us stronger. It makes us better. And whether we're just temporarily in a little silo or trying to play an organ with lots of different parts of the tune, all good. The key is to be gentle with yourself and do the best you can in the moment. But the important thing is to show up and try your best.
I agree. And you have to look at, well, what are other people not doing sometimes? I'll do that because that's like, just like you did. You worked in deforestation, you worked on palm oil and other things and realized, hey, no one's doing anything about coffee. And it's a big issue. When you look at the issue of coffee, it's so integrated with a bunch of other issues, right? You've got human rights abuses, you've got child labor, you have climate change, you've got biodiversity loss. But when we were talking before about commercial plantations and the agroforestry, we see feedback loops. So commercial plantation is actually eroding the land and accelerating climate change. But coffee has a big problem because it can only be grown in the bean belt, right? Pretty much. And the temperatures are increasing there and coffee cannot last. It looks like in 2050, we're going to lose 50% of the arable land for coffee, right? Because coffee is very finicky. It's a finicky plant.
That's correct.
But the thing is, when we have agroforestry practices, we've got this positive feedback loop. It's less water intensive. It provides nutrients to the soil, provides a habitat for species, but no one can change climate change. Climate change is here. We can just decrease the impact of climate change. And so it's in anybody's interest that works in coffee, from the big conglomerates to the small farmers, to change their practices, because otherwise no one's going to be drinking coffee in 2070. And I think, I mean, I hope I'm alive then and I still want to drink my coffee. So.
No, you're right. Scientists say that half of global coffee will vanish by 2050 unless we change how we grow it. And you hit the nail on the head. The solution is agroforestry. Agroforestry can save coffee. And incidentally, along the way, it will also save people and planet.
Yay! Yay!
Alex, it was so wonderful to do this with you. I love your show. I love you. I'm so grateful for this chance to chat with you and to connect with your listeners.
Thank you so much, Ethel, for your insight and your time. And thank you for everything you're doing at Coffee Watch.
Thank you. Big hugs, my dear.
I hope you have found this podcast insightful and will join us next time as we explore more issues affecting our environment and human rights at home and around the world. For more materials on this issue, please go to our website, thegravity.fm.